The Spectator magazine combines incisive political analysis with books and arts reviews of unrivaled authority. Subscribe today for just £12 and receive a 12-week subscription in print and online. Plus, we'll give you a £20 Amazon gift voucher, absolutely free. Go to spectator.co.uk/voucher.
Hello and welcome to Spectator's Book Club podcast. I'm Sam Leith, the literary editor of The Spectator, and my guest this week is Peter Pomerantsev, whose new book is How to Win an Information War, The Propagandist Who Outwitted Hitler. Now, that propagandist is Sefton Delmer, who isn't a name widely known. Peter, who was he and why is he not more widely known if he outwitted Hitler, as you'd claim?
Well, not only did he outwit Hitler, as we shall be exploring today, he was also, I don't know, one of the most amazing journalists of his time. He was sort of, I don't know, a mix of Tintin and Borat. He was absolutely amazing. He was the Daily Express roving foreign correspondent from the late 1920s until the late 60s. And he was a superstar. I mean, it's hard to really compare him to anyone today. We don't really have foreign correspondents of that kind of like giant stature. And he really did amazing things. I mean, he was the first foreign correspondent to get into Hitler's inner circle during the late 1920s. And he managed to sort of ingratiate, dare we say, himself so far that he was the only correspondent allowed to fly with Hitler on his famous air tours when he was sort of doing his early, very, very powerful campaigns when he was still trying to be an elected official. He did more than that. I mean, in the book, I tell about this scene where he kind of dresses up. Well, he doesn't dress up. He just impersonates a Ernst Röhm's adjutant, so basically the assistant of the head of the stormtroopers, and goes and attends a stormtrooper event, cosplaying a Nazi, essentially.
And this is because Röhm sort of says, look, we'd like to get you in this event, but it's no press, so you're going to dress as my adjutant.
So just to be clear, he didn't dress. Everybody's in civvies because it wasn't, for various reasons, the stormtroopers weren't allowed to be in dress at that point. But he's allowed to be convincing. He's allowed to do the salute. And he describes it in great detail, the way he does the Nazi salute and everyone thinks he's Röhm's adjutant. Look, he did much more than that. When I say he's a bit like Borat, he would go around sort of disguised as an embarrassing and really, really awkward and always saying the wrong things German, always talking about the war, in 1920s England. He'd go around coastal towns, a bit like Borat does in the US.
Well, I think it's checking a bit Fawlty Towers, that, isn't it?
Well, also anticipating Fawlty Towers, but really anticipating, I think Sacha Baron Cohen. And he was trying to investigate whether the British had forgiven the Germans for the war. Yeah, if he said these really embarrassing things about the war and acted like this big, boorish, comedic German, how would people react? And he found largely the British had forgiven the Germans for the war and got over it and were prepared to sort of help this idiotic character. So he was, look, I'm getting that because he was a master of impersonation and role-playing and performance. And that's kind of his modus operandi when he becomes a propagandist as well.
Well, it's, I think we should yeah. If I may ask you to sort of zoom back a bit, because this thing of him impersonating a German, he wasn't quite just impersonating a German. His childhood and the circumstance in which he grew up, at least in your description of it, seemed to be really important in understanding his subsequent makeup.
I'm very glad that you asked that question, Sam. Should I have started with that? I decided to
start with
journalism.
Not at all. No,
just, I never you know. No, it's a big question.
Great, but I think
we think we should do childhood.
It's Der Zorks. I think we need to talk about
the childhood issue. Let's talk about the socks. So, Sefton Delmer is the son of an Australian academic, a literature professor in Berlin. He's born in Berlin. He spends his childhood in Berlin. His dad is so into German culture, he gets his son to learn German first because he thinks that, you know, that's a good, you know, linguist, he should learn the language of where he lives. But he's always seen as British in his school. And when the First World War breaks out, he's bullied as this enemy school child. In 1917, his family finally managed to get out of wartime Berlin, come to London. He's finally home, you know, after being bullied and put down for being English. and he gets off the boat and he has all these children running around laughing and screaming at him and sort of pointing at his feet. And he looks down and he realizes he's wearing these Berlin sailor socks, which were very fashionable in Berlin, the Berlin little sailor's costume. Like, you know, that was what little kids in Berlin wore. While in England, of course, everybody wears your socks up to your knees. I mean, they, you know, at a certain type of era. And he suddenly realizes that he'd always thought he was English, but for the English, he's a foreigner. And he gets accused when he goes to school in London of being too German. And so he gets bullied for being too German. And this kind of like divided self, this understanding that all social roles are to a certain extent performed, and this deep, deep desire to be British and to be seen as British, but always, I think, understanding the absurdity of his attempts to be that, kind of permeate everything for him. When he talks about propaganda, I think his great insight is that the power of propaganda is that it gives people who are confused about their identity a role to play. Now, he comes back to this. He doesn't just talk about Nazi propaganda. He talks about First World War propaganda, British propaganda in World War I, German post-war propaganda. He sees patterns all the time among propaganda, not just the exclusive evil of the Nazis, which is exclusively evil, but he sees similarities. That seems very similar to today when we see so much propaganda online, which is all about striking a pose, you know, all about sort of playing a certain role. I mean, he would have had a field day with taking the mick out of social media. So that's his great power. And his understanding what, I mean, he describes the Nazis as a cabaret at first. And obviously he's living in cabaret era Berlin. And he's very aware how they're giving people these roles to perform, that people who are very lost, very discombobulated by all the changes of Weimar Germany, he gives them someone to be, someone to love, someone to hate, a role to play. And that's really his great, great insight, which for me feels very, very relevant today. And maybe with some of my complicated background, I can relate to as well.
Yes, there is. You describe your own socks moment in the book, which...
I do describe my, yeah. Do we want to talk about Robbinsfield Primary School?
Your identification.
Robbinsfield Primary School. Yes. 5? So 1982. I've just arrived to England from what is now Ukraine, from the Soviet Union. My parents were Soviet dissidents, as I relate in my last book. And I'm just learning English. And I get to school and I'm really feeling that my English is getting better. I can almost like converse with my St. John's Wood primary school mates. And we're getting changed for class, and suddenly everybody's laughing at me and pointing at my feet. And basically my mother addressed me like all kind of Soviet parents would in tights, because it was cold. That's what you do in Kyiv, or, you know, in that neck of the woods when things are cold. You put on, well, they're kind of like long johns, but they're essentially tights because everyone's so poor. They use tights, you know, whatever. It's normal. And I get there and everyone's laughing at me, and I realize that, you know, I'm not one of you. I'm just not one of you.
So you're
always parted by our tights.
No, connection with Sefton Delma right there at the root. But Delma's interest in propaganda, which he turns to, I mean, you know, he's a foreign correspondent, he's a very successful foreign correspondent, and he's off in Berlin with the Express, and he's running around, he gets to know the Nazis. Is there a point at which, in your understanding of it, he kind of starts to think that there's something more than just things to report, that you know, this, the effect of Hitler on crowds starts to interest him as a kind of phenomenon. And then when he starts thinking, I can do something against this, I mean, that transition is interesting.
So, I mean, he's very, look, it's very, one has to be careful with Sefton Delma, and I try to be in the book. There are his memoirs written in the 1960s, which are told from the perspective of somebody looking back at things. Then we're very lucky we have his reports written for the Daily Express in the 20s and 30s. But like all reportage, you can't always see what he really thinks, because as I explore in the book, reporters are often, you know, they'll play down their criticism of a political leader if they want more access, and he wanted access.
Yeah.
So like in his memoir, he's like, the minute, you know, the first time he met Hitler, he thought he was a complete dolt. In his articles, you know, the criticism is there, but much more reserved. But he's sort of honest in the sense, in the memoir, that he says the first time he sees Hitler's speeches, he thinks this guy's a loon and won't go anywhere and what a complete waste of time it is covering this movement. And then when Hitler wins the election or starts to win elections, he's like, oh, I've just completely missed something, haven't I? And he sees these sort of middle-class Germans, who's always seen as quite reserved emotionally, just having these orgies of anger. And he's like, whoa, there's something weird happening here. What is interesting, again, about his like analysis of the Nazi crowd, and where I think he's different to a lot of other people who've looked at it, because a lot of people talk about the sort of the crowd effect of Hitler. What he does is he says the more he travels with Hitler, the more he realizes to what extent Hitler is acting. And he's very, very good at really getting to the details of how Hitler transforms just before he goes on stage and then goes back to being this very depressed guy eating a raw egg and staring blankly out the window and then turning into this demigod. But he's very interesting that he seems to be saying that the crowd is also acting a little bit. So that's slightly different to what a lot of people say about the Nazi crowd, who say they're in a hypnotic orgy. Yeah? Well, he's saying actually that hypnosis is sort of another role that you play. Now, I don't explore it in the book. The other person who picked up on it is somebody very different to Delmer. Delmer's a sort of, obviously, sort of more a sort of conservative, but a left-wing critic, Theodore Adorno, picked up on this as well. He has a very interesting essay, which I remember reading, where he talks about something very similar, that the people in the Nazi crowd are actually acting hypnosis. I think the closest thing is going to a rave. We're like, oh man, I'm so into this music. I'm in such a trance. Well, you're not really. You're kind of acting a trance. You know, there might be a little moment there, depending on how misspent your youth was, where you really did enter a trance-like state. But most of the time, it's another role you're playing and you can actually switch out of it quite fast. So Delmer's saying that even in this sort of peak orgy, people are playing a little bit. And if you can find that chink where people are acting and separate it from their other interests, their other selves, you can start undermining this propaganda.
And he was desperate to get involved in the information war, wasn't he? He was back in the UK. And there's this whole period when he's kind of trying to get the Secret Service or whatever to sign him up because he knows there's something he can do, but he can't.
He sort of relives the trauma of his childhood because, again, he's not one of us. He's got very influential friends. He went to Lincoln College, Oxford. He's got very well-connected friends. One of his friends is sort of a deputy head of the Special Operations Executive, and they're trying to get him in. They know that this is the guy who understands the German national psyche better than most Brits. But he just keeps on failing clearance, partly because he was too close. He was suspiciously close for some to the Nazis when he was covering them. And there's like, I go through his SAS dossier in my book, and you know, there's all these people saying he was way too close to them, we don't trust him, how come he got onto the plane with the Nazis, was he sympathetic to them? And there's lots of emigres who accuse him of that. There's people within the British establishment who are suspicious of him, which is very unfair, because actually, as early as 1933, he's writing notes to Lord Beaverbrook, who's his boss, the head of the Express, that we're going to have to go to war with the Nazis. He was actually very early in understanding the threat they posed. So it was very, very unfair because his closeness, his proximity, gave him the insight about how dangerous they were. He knew appeasement wouldn't work. But because he'd managed to get so close to them, he was deemed a little bit suspicious. Finally, they do let him in after like a year of trying, basically.
And what did he do? Now, I should ask, actually. You say, I think, one of the reasons he's not better known is that there was a sense we wanted to kind of sweep the fact that his empire of tricks, the sort of dirty trickery, the black propaganda stuff, we don't want to have that associated with the way we won the war. Has all the stuff about him been declassified? Are you able to go through all these files, or is there still a lot of it that's not known?
So it was his son, Felix Delmer, who actually gave an interview. One of the rare documentaries about Delmer. This means to be one made a decade or something, maybe a couple. Don't quote me on the numbers, but not a lot. But he said that. He said that the reason that it's never been suppressed, but it's not focused on. It's like as if we push it away from our public consciousness, like, oh, all that dirty stuff. No, we don't want to think about that. There's a bit of that going on. So he wrote his memoirs in the 60s and they were actually well known. He was on TV all the time. He even had This Is Your Life done about him. And then a couple of other people who worked on the operations basically follow exactly what he said. So he got clearance to write his memoirs. And it's a very kind of compressed version of what happened. You know, then it was kind of forgotten in the 70s, 80s, 90s, and so on. In the 90s, this amazing archivist and historian Lee Richards, without whom this book is impossible. By the way, I'm not a historian. Can I just say that? And my interest in Delmer is of someone who studies propaganda today, mining the past, probably in very ahistorical ways. Actually, definitely, completely ahistorical ways in order to inspire the present. And I make no bones about that. I am not even dimly
it's
a historian.
It's not at all a straight history.
I make that like... just to tell all the historians out there, I am not like you guys, I hope they write the real histories. My work is me, somebody today who wants to understand propaganda, what we can do today, drawing inspiration from the past. Just very clear on that. But, so there is a real historian, Lee Richards, who did all the FOIAs and got all the archive, or a lot of the archive, is the Political War Executive Archive, which has all the notes of sort of where he's explaining his strategies, sort of almost a day-by-day breakdown of what the idea was, what they were trying to do in all these amazing operations that we haven't discussed yet,
let me just get into
what he did in the war. But... So there's all that evidence of reception. So how do we know that people were listening to the media he created? So a trove there that Lee Richards is not only declassified, but is in the process of organizing. And he helped me a lot. Without him, I could never do this. But the real clincher for me was, again, thanks to Lee Richards, that I discovered that we have the transcripts of the radio shows Delmer created. Delmer ran around, dozens of radio stations, covert radio stations broadcasting into Nazi Germany and occupied Europe. And we have the transcripts of a lot of them. And we have the transcripts because the Americans thought that these were actual Nazi stations, and therefore they recorded them as actual Nazi stations. And you have the notes of the transcribers going, we're not sure where this station is coming from. It's probably in France or something. It's very interesting. when actually this was part of a vast media operation that was being run by Delmer from Bedfordshire. And now might be a good time to say what he did, because I think the listeners are now completely confused. Right. So basically what Delmer did was create dozens and run dozens of radio stations, which were like a kind of sort of masquerade cabaret. They were full of German emigres, many of them from the cabaret scene in Berlin, who were impersonating Nazis. And what they would do would, I mean, one very famous station that he had called Der Chef, it was done by sort of a patriotic soldier who was furious at Nazi officials for their corruption, but was also a fan of Hitler, would use all this, frankly, racist rhetoric, constantly swearing at Churchill, saying that the Luftwaffe should bomb Britain more, but it's full of secret Bolsheviks and secret British spies, and giving these incredible detail about the corruption of mid-level Nazi officials. All done to kind of like poison the relationship between the Nazi party and the German people, show the cracks between the army and Nazi elites, but really full of this sort of searing humor and highly entertaining pornography. So that was the first thing he did, but then he built it up and built
it's
it
really
up.
It's really interesting
built it up.
This propaganda depended on being full of really accurate information, didn't it?
So this is the thing. The revelatory bit for me, and when I decided to write the book about this, was A, when I started reading the transcripts and realized just how good they were. I mean, they're so... These shows are just terrific, terrific radio literature. They're just wonderfully written. But also, when I worked out two things. One, as you say, beneath the sort of masquerade that he was creating, these sort of alternative fronts that he had, was actually this huge mass of truth that he researched. So he was a great believer that you've got to actually, to get audiences and to get them to trust you, you've got to be incredibly detailed. So his idea was that we're going to tell soldiers more about their lives and German citizens more about their lives than Nazi propaganda does. And he had this huge research machine, which included opening letters between Nazi officials and their relatives in the US, which included partisans giving him loads of details about which German general was sleeping with which prostitutes in Calais and which diseases she had, which included not just interviewing POWs, but putting microphones in POW camps so you could pick up on all the rumors and chatter that soldiers discussed amongst themselves, and so on and so on and so on. So it was full of this visceral detail that made them feel very relevant to people. But also, and here's where it gets really interesting for me. From 1943 onwards, Germans were meant to understand that these were the Brits cosplaying Nazis. And the Brits wanted them to understand that. So it's not actually even deception. What he was doing was creating a safe space, dare we say, for Germans to express and act upon their dissatisfaction and resentment of the Nazis. So safe in what way? Safe as somebody walked in on you, you could say, oh, I thought it was a Nazi station, sir. And I thought this was like patriotic. This is not the BBC, sir. Listening to the BBC was punishable by hanging. So it gave
plausible
you cover.
Deniability.
Yeah, it gave you plausible deniability. And a lot of POWs say that. They're like, thank you, you know, for giving us that. But even more so, and here we get, I think, into like the depth and dexterity that Delmer and his team had. It was about giving them a psychological alibi. They all write about this. Delmer writes about it. The other memoirs that I've managed to get during my research, and there is a little bit of original research I've managed to gather, memoirs that have been lost to the public. And they all write about how what they were doing, what they'd worked out, that it was easier for people to be disloyal to their country if it was done through a we. Yeah, if you say you Germans should rebel, doesn't work. When it's like we Germans are really unhappy, something in your brain makes it easier. Yeah, and by giving
is that
it,
the obverse of the whole Hitler crowd thing? That I mean, the basic rhetorical thing that ethos, your identity with the crowd, is what licenses whatever your personal instincts are.
Well, what he was stressing was your other we, as in like it was your camaraderie with your soldiers, it was your family. He was saying, you know, I suppose one way to analyze it, the Nazis were trying to create this hysterical crowd, all fused together in the idea of the folk, yeah, which was sort of a created psychological community. And he was saying, no, there are other we's. There's your old relationships among soldiers, which is stronger than that one. Yeah, we can also mean your family ties. There was a lot in there about looking after your family members. So Delmer would give news about where the RAF had hit a German city, and give that news really early before the Nazis had reported on it, and tell people, look, if you're from this town, actually if you're from this street, because he could give details of streets, you now have the right for some leave because your family might be there. You can go and take care of your loved ones. So obviously something, they did have those rights according to Nazi law. Obviously not something the Nazis wanted to stress too much. So he was stressing those other bonds all the time. But it's so interesting. And so people understood it was the British doing this. But the level of detail was so rich and genuine, and the creation of an alternative and in some ways more genuine we than the Nazi crowd was so motivating that people were prepared to listen and trust this media, even though they knew literally their deadly enemies were creating it. So talking about sort of breaking through echo chambers or partisanship. I mean, this is the greatest partisanship you can imagine. Literally, like the people trying to kill you are broadcasting this. You know that. And yet you go, oh my God, they understand so much about me and my life that I'm going to tune into them and act upon it. Because he was also encouraging people to surrender and defect. And
also,
stuff
some
like
of the technical stuff is extraordinary, that they had this newswire machine, which meant that they knew what was going on, you know, all the things that the Germans would be broadcasting the following day. They were scooping them, weren't they?
Yeah. So the Germans had something called a Hellschreiber, which was it's like a very, very, very sophisticated telegram machine, I suppose. some Telegram expert is now ranting at me. For me, that's what it is, but very sophisticated, which exactly would be a way for the Goebbels propaganda ministry to shoot out what are the main communiques of the day. Because Delmer's radio was, I think it's hours, I can't remember now, but I think it's hours started a lot earlier than regular Nazi stations. They could scoop the Nazis and they could get like a Goebbels communique out earlier than the Nazis would. But look, they did a lot of fantastical things. So they learned to essentially hack into Goebbels' speeches and rebroadcast them on their stations. And they'd give the Goebbels speech. And towards the end, when they were getting quite cocky, They'd do comments during the speech. They'd learn Goebbels' cadences so well. So they'd be going like in between, like Goebbels would give a statistic and they sort of butt in and go, well, that statistic's wrong. It's actually this amount. So imagine sort of rebroadcasting Trump live. This is not recorded and then cut in a comedy skit. This is live and kind of inserting fact checks very ironically on the way. I mean, obviously by that point, you're not even hiding that you're the British, but that's since 1945. So that's already like very late on, like after D-Day. But they were doing all sorts of stuff which really kind of like sort of exploded Nazi propaganda in a subversive but also very liberating way.
He moved on to do some, towards the end of the war, some stuff that's a bit darker.
A bit?
Quite a lot darker, in
a
fact.
A bit?
I mean, I'm quite captivated by the thing you described in your introduction, how his daughter finds him, you know, he's writing his memoirs, and she said, Daddy, were you a goody-goody or a baddie-baddie? And he's like, no, I'm a baddie-baddie. How conflicted was he, and what was that dark stuff he was doing?
So look, the darker stuff, there's a lot of dark stuff. When you start going through the archives, not just Delmer's work, by the way, but just if you start going through the archives of the Political Warfare Executive, there's some dark stuff. I mean, frankly, none of it's as dark as firebombing Dresden. So I think whenever we say dark stuff, I mean, like, it's the Second World War. You're trying to beat the Nazis. We did a lot of dark stuff. And I think actually putting any of the psychological information stuff on a level of sort of like moral ambiguity with Dresden or Hiroshima just seems stupid, frankly.
Yeah.
So when we're talking dark, like, okay, let's get this.
I mean, dark compared to Der Chef, at least.
Well, the darkness was, so one thing he writes about that he had big moral issues with afterwards, or some moral issues with afterwards, he would get grieving German parents to feel that their kids were still alive. So he'd write these letters to, he had a team of Oxford educated forgers doing this. These letters would be written to grieving parents, pretending to be their kids or friends of their kids, saying, actually, you know, Friedrich is still alive. He's having a great life in England. Hint, hint, tell everybody how great it is to defect. So he was exploiting people's grieving parents' need to feel their kids were still alive. He knew the parents were because the parents kept on writing to the British because they wouldn't believe that the kids were dead. They'd write to the British saying, we know that Friedrich's not dead. We feel it. We just sense that he's not dead. Is he with you guys? And like, you know, the Secret Services would give this to Delmer and go, John, we don't know what to do with this. And then Delmer's like, oh, I know. And he said that he felt bad about this afterwards. He makes up for it in a really weird way in the war. He then sends them sort of hampers of food saying, oh, Friedrich, this is from Friedrich. So thus further making them feel that their son's alive, but this time they would get some nice food, which was a big deal in 19, sort of towards the end of the war. And in his memoirs, he says that this was sort of some way of compensating them for what he'd done. I don't know if it really made things better.
Maybe not. Like,
but there was stuff like that. And look, no, in my book, I'm looking at the positive and negative lessons from Delmer. I'm no way saying we can cut and paste him. It's his, he's working in the war. He's learning as he goes. He never really theorizes what he's doing.
Yeah, you say he
to
doesn't
a scholarly
actually define
extent.
Propaganda himself when he talks about
None
it.
None of them do. They're all mentioning about it. They all use the word incredibly loosely to mean kind of anything. Anything that's mass influence. Yeah, he doesn't have time to do that. And that's, he's not thus inclined.
But as you describe it, he does have, at least implicitly, different theory than the people who came before. Is that fair to say?
Oh, no. He's very clear on tactics. So he doesn't do the academic definition of propaganda, which I do in the book. There's these really annoying academic asides where I sort of go, well, as we're talking about propaganda, let's discuss what it is, which I'm sorry for the readers. The readers who don't need that, they can just flip over that. They're really clearly marked in the book. Others might enjoy that. There's not too much of that. It's never longer than 800 words. I was very self-disciplined, but As somebody who sort of teaches at university, I felt I needed these little things.
Yeah,
as
you
well.
Know, when his students teasing you.
Yeah. No, but he's very, very clear about what he wants to do. I mean, we have his sort of detailed, very frequent sort of, you know, policy descriptions to his bosses. His big arguments are, it's pointless looking for a democratic, liberal movement in Germany. That's gone. So what the BBC and the other covert stations, because he didn't create the first covert station, just to be clear, there were others beforehand, but he thought they were totally ineffective. They were sort of staffed by idealistic social democrats, kind of trying to inspire social democratic revolution. He was like, it's gone. You know, maybe that worked kind of in World War I a little bit when there was a revolution that brought down the Kaiser. But now Hitler's got total control, whether through fear or genuine support. It's a bit like Putin now. He's got a lockdown. He's got a lockdown. Stop hoping for a democratic revolution. Yeah. Our aim is now to ruin the Nazi war machine and the Nazi propaganda machine and to win a war. Our aim is to undermine them rather than to feed ourselves the false hope of a democratic uprising. Now, during the book, as I kind of like scratch through it, I do actually think there was a very deep democratic core to him, but it wasn't about preaching. He definitely doesn't believe in preaching, in lectures, about extolling the virtues of liberalism. He's sort of like, we've got to forget about all that and really get into the relationship between Hitler and Germans and break that relationship.
Oh, God, he's got this lovely quote. I was just shocking. The simplest and most effective of all black operations, he wrote, is to spit in a man's soup and cry, Heil Hitler. Very idealistic. No.
Yes. I mean, he was so much more sophisticated than that. But yeah.
Just briefly, actually, that does touch on one of the insistent themes of the book, because you've done an awful lot of work in Ukraine and you've been out there, you've been involved on the ground and documenting war crimes and all. And, you know, you're interested in weaponizing Delbin, not cutting and pasting him, but talking about how he relates to the present. Is the situation in Putin's Russia analogous to the, you know, there's no hope of a democratic uprising in Germany? I know you used Jade McGlynn's figures on Russian reception of Putinism. Where do you think we are? How relevant is it?
Oh, it's look, you always got to caveat this. The Nazis were uniquely nasty and they, in a way, you know, they exist in their own world of bad that we shouldn't compare to. However, Delmer sees patterns of propaganda not just, you know, among the Nazis. So he himself sees patterns, especially in Germany, and patterns in the seduction of authoritarian propaganda. So because he sees the Nazis as a continuation of the Kaiser's Germany. So in that sense, I think we can make comparisons. There are patterns here, and I don't want to start making glib sort of like equals signs, yeah? Because history's not like that. However, there are patterns, and there's much we can learn from him. Yes, I think that at the moment, it's not just Jade's numbers. There's bits of sociology that I still get to see, and they all agree that there's like a segmentation to do about Russian society, much the same as the British found when they did a segmentation of German society, which they did towards the end of the war. And you've got like your hardcore sort of like 10, 12%, whatever your methodology is, will give you a different figure of like, in Germany, it was determined Nazis. In Russia, it's kind of like hardcore, aggressive, expansionist, supremacist, imperialists. Then you have a lot more who are just loyal and aggressive. Then you've got many more who are just conformist and will just go along with whatever Putin says. Then you've got your kind of resentful people economically who are like, just like, they don't care, but they feel very economically exposed because they're a bit like the Berlin working class in Germany. You know, they're sort of like, they get hit by a lot of the consequences much earlier of your leader waging a war. And then there's your liberals, which are, again, the figures vary, 10%, 12%, how many of those have already left the country anyway? And if there was a period in Russia, as in Germany, where look, they could self-organize, that has been, for all intents and purposes, smashed for the moment. I mean, Alexei Navalny was just murdered, the leader of the Russian opposition, and you know, there's no mass protests in Russia. Again, so we do have to think about something else. To the extent that we think about anything, so The big difference, of course, is that we were at war with Nazi Germany. And so far with Russia, we're in a halfway house. We're helping Ukraine. And the Ukrainians are doing this sort of stuff. They just don't have the capacity to do a massive scale of it. So what are they doing? I mean, they're doing very modern versions of this, you know. They sort of put banner ads on porn sites and bootleg video sites where they know Russian soldiers might go to and where they can get ads up. Sort of if you click through the ads, they'll take you to ways to surrender and defect from the army. So stuff like that, probably much more than that, you know, for very good reasons. During a war, you don't know all the psyops that are being done. That's kind of classic. I mean, what would be really great if, for it to have more effect, you'd want something like a huge radio station broadcasting at all Russian soldiers, which is constantly giving very, very well-resourced leaks, which are much easier to get hold of now than then, about all the sort of corruption and disease and iniquities and bad equipment and all that rot of the Russian army being sort of transmitted nonstop to the soldiers and to the people watching. We saw when Prigozhin, this demented multimillionaire mercenary leader, went against Putin, started saying this stuff. The audiences he got were huge. And, you know, I mentioned in the book that the people who were interested were soldiers, obviously, because it was he was talking about how bad conditions were in the army, but also just regular conformists who were like, oh, that is, you're allowed to say this? Actually, you're allowed to say this?
There's a good parallel you make with Deschef, that it's Prigozhin, I guess, his ethos appeal to the Russians is stronger because he's obviously in favour of the war. He's not a kind of hand-wringing liberal social democrat who's anti-imperialist. He's saying, you know, we should absolutely be smashing the Ukrainians, but we're just not doing it right.
So just for the listeners who don't know who Prigozhin is, Prigozhin was sort of the leader of Russia's mercenaries, very close to Putin, almost had like a second army, a private army in Ukraine, and for a long time did a lot of Putin's dirty work for him, and then got a bit too big for his boots and started complaining and saying that all the army chiefs should go, and was quickly bumped off. What Prigozhin teaches us is when you have somebody like that criticizing, people are really ready to listen. The big difference, and we've got to be very clear here, Prigozhin did want to lead a political movement. He had political ambitions, clearly. He probably wanted to run the army himself or something. Delmer wasn't. So Delmer's Deschef, who we mentioned, but all his other stations, they were never meant to be a genuine political movement. He was looking for a way to communicate the truth. He was giving people a mask under which they could say what they really thought. It was never about creating an alternative political movement. It was about, actually, if anything, sort of like getting people to be self-interested, not to follow a new leader. He wasn't trying to say, this is your new leader.
The Schweinhund.
He talks about the Schweinhund, the pig dog, sort of getting you to think about your self-interest, which also makes you think about your individuality, I think, a lot more. So he wasn't trying to lead an alternative movement. He was sort of creating a characters who might be in one who allowed you to listen in. Which, again, Prigozhin's very interesting because the people who... There's been some analysis of the Russians who listened to Prigozhin. It wasn't just soldiers and mercenaries. It was ordinary people who don't want to serve, who were very interested to hear, oh, what are they saying in the army? You know, well, is that really what's going on? So they weren't people who wanted to follow Prigozhin. They were people actually who want to avoid serving as much as possible. You know, they're not the ones who like are rushing into the forces, but it was just incredible eavesdropping onto the sort of contradictions within the system.
And come back to your title, How to Win an Information War. Did Delmer win the information war? That's kind of question that seems to be more open than you'd expect towards the end of your book.
So as some, you know, it's very hard to measure the effects of any media, simply because there are so many inputs that go into people's lives. Even something like an election campaign, it's very hard to say what led to what. We can do so with a bit more accuracy now because we have sort of digital tracing and we have much more targeted ways of knowing where our media went and how people there behaved, but it's still very, very hard. Back then, it was much harder. Delmer never makes any claims to kind of that he won the war. He basically said information is part of a larger war effort, the military that come first, then the economic warfare, and then information helps you. I think today as well, even without getting into military war, without good policies, you know, there's nothing that information can do
that is magical. You know, if we were with Russia, even without the military stuff, you need policies towards Russia, you need much better economic sanctions, and then the information can help. You know, it can't work wonders. So firstly, let's put information in the right place among all your other tools. In his case, what we do know, we know from the POWs that were taken, the German POWs, like about 40% said they listened to his stations. That's a lot. Sort of almost equal numbers with the BBC, sometimes more than the BBC even. And judging that he had a couple of wavelengths while the BBC had loads and much better brand recognition, that's really remarkably successful. Firstly. Secondly, there's lots of sort of stories about individual defections being inspired by it. So there's a great story about how this submarine commander, who the British knew was stationed somewhere off England, because they had, you know, Delon was working very closely with sort of naval intelligence, with Ian Fleming, actually, who was his sort of friend and benefactor in many ways. So they knew that this guy had a submarine stationed off the coast of England, and they sort of broadcast a musical show saying, here's a song for Captain so-and-so to congratulate him with the birth of a child. And they played him a tune. And he surfaced the submarine and surrendered, saying, I haven't been home in 2 years. Oh, what a child. And it's just the extent to which he trusted the information there, that they wouldn't just make that stuff up. And knew perfectly well it was the British.
Had they made that stuff up?
So this is a hard one to fathom, because that story is actually, it's actually in the OSS, sort of the American Secret Services write about the story. So I've never been able to trace the origins of that story, whether they provoked him or whether they had found it out. It's the sort of stuff they could have found out. So just to explain, they had like Max Brown, who ran the archive department, who was the former leader of the Social Democrats in the Tsar region. He had these sort of like, they had to build special new kind of buildings to house his archive. He had these sort of little card files about, which told the story of Nazi officials, their relatives, their family, same with soldiers, same with officers, collected through all these different sources, also collected through newspaper articles. So they had this incredible database about who was serving where, who was in charge, who their family members were. It would have been very easy for them to check if, like, you know, somebody's wife had just given birth. So it's the sort of thing that they could have checked quite easily.
It's kind of analog Bellingcat stuff.
Yes, open source research. Exactly. They were doing open source research. Exactly. Very well put. So anyway, to talk about effects. So we have different stories like that, little sort of individual moments where people resigned or defected or crossed over the lines. The Valkyria leaders, so the short-lived rebellion against Hitler towards the end of the war, they were listening to the stations and they are inspired by them. So you have those sorts of examples. And then you have the examples of the Nazis. So Goebbels writing his diary about how annoyed he is by Delmer and how these stations are problematic. The head of the SS in Munich writing in to his superiors saying, these stations are now among the top three listened to in Munich and are causing complete chaos. So we have the reactions of the Germans, and the Germans are constantly caught in this catch-22. Do they tell Germans that these are fake British stations, or does that only raise their profile? And they try to do it in various ways, and none of them kind of work, basically. But so those are all indicators that it was significant.
Peter Bonrazif, thank you very much.